Thank you, ladies. Lovely piece of music. Always pleasant to add to the Holy Day atmosphere. I do have to say that pianist looks very familiar. How many sermons do you think you've heard during the days of unleavened bread that drew on the example of the Israelites? How high can you count? Let's add one more this morning. With a wrinkle, I have several. Somebody was reminding me of that before services. This gentleman was saying he was going through some old notebooks of sermon notes, and he found some notes from the Feast of Tabernacles in St. Petersburg, Florida in 1987. And he said, I looked up and I saw somebody's name there that I recognized. Gave a couple of sermonettes at that feast. Back then, we had these huge feast sites of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, and even those of us who'd been in the ministry for a while then, well, either we got to have the whole feast off, or sometimes we got called upon for giving something very unfamiliar, a sermonette. How do you give a sermonette? How do you speak for only 12 minutes? But somehow, I guess, it happened. I do distinctly recall that I shared the lectern with Mr. Roy Demarest that one day. I had the sermonette and he had the sermon. I pointed out that we were so different in age that I had been a camper when he had been my counselor at summer camp in Orr, Minnesota. He very helpfully replied that I was probably one of the oldest campers that he ever saw, and he was one of the youngest counselors. So, he had the last word. So let's add a sermon this morning with a wrinkle. Probably a good number of those messages you've heard dealt with Israel in slavery in Egypt, or Israel leaving Egypt, or Israel before Mount Sinai, Israel and the golden calf, Israel in the wilderness for 40 years, Israel murmuring and testing Moses' patience to the point that once he lost that patience, and so on. Most of those sermons, I suspect, dealt with issues with the Israelites during the leadership of Moses, assisted by his brother Aaron right from the start. You'll remember that Moses protested when God called him that he didn't speak well. And God said, I know your brother Aaron is a good speaker, and you are not getting out of this that easily. All of those things are loaded with lessons for us, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10. I won't turn there. But we also know that after the death, first of Aaron and then later Moses, while they were still in the wilderness, they were prepared to cross into the promised land, but they hadn't done it yet. Moses was given a glimpse from a mountaintop, and then God took him, it says, and he hid the body so that perhaps they wouldn't get involved in some sort of worship of relics. But at any rate, another remarkable man took over the leadership of Israel after Moses was gone. Here's the question for today. What happened under the leadership of Joshua? And another question, did the story plot change? The answer to that really, I believe, has to be yes and no. Yes and no. I'm guessing the connection we associate with Joshua is perhaps that famous phrase in Joshua 1 and verse 6, in Joshua 1 and verse 7, in Joshua 1 and verse 9, in Joshua 1 and verse 18, and a few other places in the book, be strong and of good courage. Why? Well, because of where they were going. That's a powerful message and a theme that resonates throughout the book that bears his name, which is filled with lessons for us. But even that famous phrase didn't originate in the book of Joshua. It's what Moses told Joshua as they discussed the transition to his leadership before the death of Moses. The phrase appears three times in Deuteronomy chapter 31, in verses 6, 7, and 23. So here's the question. Where should we go this morning in the message? What's special about Joshua and about his time of leadership? In some ways, it's hard to limit that to the book of Joshua. The example of Israel as a nation starts before him, and it continues after his death, as we all know. And most often, as I said, we associate Israel and Days of Unleavened Bread connections with the lifetime of Moses, Joshua's predecessor, his famous predecessor. But did the leopard change his spots? In this case, the leopard being Israel. Israel as a nation, did they change essentially when Moses died? I think you'll find the answer to that specific question is no, they really didn't. So what did I mean when I said earlier to the answer to the question, did the plot of the story change? And I said, well, it's yes and no. What did I mean by that? That's getting ahead of the story. We'll get there. Stop and think for a minute about these two men and the leadership times they had with Israel. Most of what we focus on during the leadership of Moses is Israel leaving Egypt and traveling toward the promised land in the wilderness. Israel leaving Egypt and Israel in the wilderness. Most of what we read about during the leadership of Joshua is Israel having crossed the Jordan River, entered the promised land, and taking possession. There's a subtle difference. And there's a subtle difference that's reflected in the Days of Unleavened Bread. Stop and think for a moment about the man himself. What kind of person was Joshua? The first place his name is mentioned is in the book of Exodus in chapter 17. At this point in their history, the Israelites have left Egypt. The Egyptian army is dead, drowned in the Red Sea. The Israelites had already complained about lack of food. Pattern was established. And as a result, they had their first experience with manna, which basically literally meant, what is it? What is this? And that's the way it is translated in the New King James Version in chapter 16 and verse 15. They said, what is it? They didn't know what it was. Moses said, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. It describes it. Doesn't sound too bad, actually. It was easy to fix, easy to bake, easy to pick up, except when it melted in the morning sun. They then complained about lack of water. I think we detect a pattern. Just when it seemed that things could not get any worse, they did. Exodus 17 and verse 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So here we're introduced to a remarkable man, Joshua, the successor to Moses, eventually, not yet, of course. Joshua did what Moses told him to do. Verse 10, Joshua did as Moses said and fought with Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And we know that story, how his arms became heavy and tired, and Aaron and Hur held them up so that he could plead with God and beseech God to intervene. Amalek is defeated, verses 13 and 14. And God specifically says something in verses 13 and 14. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." So even in this early stage, God is setting something special aside for Joshua. And he specifically tells Moses, write this in that book I've told you about. Perhaps it was in the book in the side of the ark. There are lots of interesting possibilities and speculations. Not the tablets of the stone inside. And he says, and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. He will need to know this. So what are we introduced to here? What kind of a man are we talking about? Dependable, trustworthy, brave, strong, courageous. All those would apply. Joshua was also, we know, one of the 12 spies sent by Moses to forge on ahead into the promised land before the nation moved in. That's in Numbers 13 and verse 8. I won't go there to go through the details, but you can find the listing. He was of the tribe of Ephraim, who of course was the younger son of Joseph, but was favored by Jacob's hands being crossed for that special blessing that he gave in Genesis 48. And 49, Deuteronomy 33, we know the story. Caleb was from the tribe of Judah. That's in verse 6 of the same reference, Numbers 13. There was also another spy from Joseph from Manasseh. His name is given in verse 11. And there was no Levite among the 12 spies. No one from Levi. We know the story. Only Caleb and Joshua were faithful as you come through the rest of Numbers 13 and on into chapter 14. But think about what this means about Joshua and see if you can find some correlation to your life and mine. This is all what Joshua had to go through. We know what happened after the spies came back. Remember? Joshua and Caleb remained faithful. They said, God has given us this land. This is where he intends for us to settle. He will be with us. And the 10 spies exaggerated the dangers and saw only difficulties and trouble ahead, not opportunity. And so we know the story, how eventually in chapter 14 of Numbers, and it's about verse 34, I believe, the day for a year principle, for the 40 days the spies searched out the land, you will wander a total of 40 years in the wilderness. Ask yourself a question. Why did Joshua and Caleb have to wander 40 years? Did they do anything worthy of it? No, they didn't. Have you or I ever had to suffer because of a sin we didn't commit? Of the actions around us in some fashion, of the world in which we live sometimes? Well, of course we have. Have you ever had to chafe under that? Have you ever asked God, why did you allow that? Or have you ever given the ultimate statement from all children, including God's children, that's not fair? Anybody ever heard that before? Anybody ever said that before? Keep your hands down, please. That's not fair. What about Joshua? Did he or Caleb deserve to wander 40 years? No, they didn't. But they did wander 40 years in the desert. Why? Because the other 10 spies lied and were faithless. And because the people listened to them and lost heart. Maybe we don't think of that as being a Days of Unleavened Bread lesson, but it can be. It can be. We do have to certainly stay on our guard during this week of time, especially if we're still carrying on some normal activities, working at our jobs, going to school, whatever it is. And, you know, suppose you're going to school and you're having lunch with your friends, and somebody says, man, this is really a great sandwich. You want to take a bite and see what it tastes like? Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. Of course, they may look at what you have and say, what is it? Sin is tough enough to remove from our own lives. And yet sin itself, by its very nature, spreads. And it impacts all around it, just like leaven. Just like it did in Joshua's time and in Joshua's life. You know, something struck me from the book of Hebrews in that regard. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, of course, is the chapter following Hebrews 11. That's very profound. Please write it in your notes. The faith chapter comes right before this. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You probably realize that the name Joshua and the name Jesus are essentially the same name, but in different language bases, Hebrew or Greek. And I just thought, as I was putting this sermon together, and I read verse 3, it's talking about Jesus Christ, but it could also have been describing Joshua when they came back from searching out the land, being surrounded by 10 others who lied about it, or exaggerated it, or who didn't have a faithful approach to go forward and obey God. Endured such hostility from sinners. I wouldn't have wanted to have been in that group making the report when Joshua said something, and then one of the 10 said something, and then Caleb said, well, wait a minute, and then another of the 10, and another of the 10, and another, and another, and another. I thought about that. Did Joshua complain? Did he murmur about his fate? Yes, he had some weak moments. We'll see one a bit later in the sermon. But that wasn't the tenor of his life. That didn't describe him. It doesn't describe him as a man. What describes him as a leader and as a servant of God was what he was called upon to do, to go forward. Look at Numbers chapter 27. Numbers 27 describes the fact that Moses was not going to go into the promised land, and God gives him instructions. Verse 12 of Numbers 27. Now the Lord said to Moses, get up into this Mount Abarim and see the land which I've given to the children of Israel. And when you've seen it, you shall be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. So Aaron is already dead. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. And God's answer came back. The Eternal said to Moses, take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He'll stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, he and all the congregation of Israel with him, all the congregations. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, commissioned him, the marginal reference says in the edition I have, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. That was the man we're talking about. Chosen to lead Israel forward. Moses was chosen to lead them out of Egypt and through the wilderness. God does exactly what should be done. He knows exactly what to do. In Deuteronomy chapter 34 and verse 9, after Moses' death, we just find this reference in Deuteronomy 34 and verse 9. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, so the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Eternal had commanded Moses. He was in charge. He was chosen. He was to succeed the man who led them from slavery and from Egypt, a type of sin. And he was to take over and lead them forward into their inheritance. I think you're beginning to hear some overtones. Themes of the days of unleavened bread, to be sure. It's interesting, there's no direct mention of Joshua in the faith chapter of Hebrews 11. And yet these descriptions make it clear that he was a man of faith. Only the oblique reference to the walls of Jericho falling by faith, Hebrews 11:30, and I suppose you could also apply to him that more general reference to subduing kingdoms in Hebrews 11:33, and wandering in deserts and mountains in Hebrews 11:38. But Joshua was the one who relayed the instructions from God about Jericho, and the people in that instance at least obeyed. All but one man. More on that later. The result in Jericho's case, the walls fell down. And God fought that battle for them. But let's go to the book of Joshua and let's start pulling a few lessons out, keeping in mind that focus. Moses leading them from Egypt. Joshua leading them into an inheritance. One of the early stories from Joshua is an interesting story. It's the story of Rahab. It's in chapter 2. We find that Joshua, imitating Moses' action and sending 12 spies to the land as a whole, sent two spies to take a look at Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. These men didn't go there because of her profession. That wasn't the point. Something was going on in the mind of this woman that only God knew, and he directed this. Yes, she lied to the authorities. She did not yet fully embrace this new way of life. She didn't understand it yet. But clearly God was working with her, even though she didn't fully grasp everything. When you come down to verses 9 to 11, look at what she says to them. She said to the men, I know that the Eternal has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For now we've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you destroyed. As soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he's God in heaven above and on earth beneath. That was a remarkable statement for someone from a polytheistic background of various gods that were thought to have their powers restricted to the lands that people worshiped them in. That was typical back then and continued for some many years, clear into the time of the prophets and the kings, David, Solomon, Saul before them. Before we criticize Rahab too much, think of what she was doing, what she was risking. And frankly, her response to what she could see about Israel and Israel's God was more respectful and responsive and yielded than that of several native-born Israelites, as we know from the story. She was willing to risk everything for a God she barely knew at all because she could see his power. She was willing to go forward into the unknown. Does that jive with the theme and the story of Joshua's leadership? I think it does. Basically, she only knew him by reputation, by what she heard about Israel and what had happened to the nations that opposed them. Later, when the city fell in chapter 6, she and her family were spared by God. This was God's doing. Interesting, though, she still has that description. Not fully understood why. I suppose she's mentioned twice in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11:31, in the faith chapter, and in James 2 and verse 25. In both of those places, she is still identified as Rahab the harlot. Sounds strange to us. Why not Rahab the spy saver? Or Rahab the repentant, has a sort of an alliterative ring to it. Why not Rahab the courageous? How would we like it if we were mentioned by name in the Bible, only by adding on our most embarrassing sin in the description? Not so great. Why did God have it recorded that way? I don't think Rahab ever read it, you know, but it's recorded that way. We aren't told. Maybe he wanted, in the record of his people that they would read later and study for hundreds of years, to emphasize what changes his faith and his power and his forgiveness can accomplish in a person's life. But one thing we know, Rahab is in the faith chapter. And both times she's mentioned in the New Testament, it is to emphasize her faith in God. In the faith chapter of Hebrews 11, and in James's explanation that our faith is demonstrated by our works, James 2:25. He cited her as an example. Either way, she comes up smelling like roses. She embraced a new way of life. She went forward, out of sin, into an inheritance. What about you and me? Can we learn from her example? Boldly go forward to obey God, no matter what the consequences might seem to be? Here's another lesson. Look at Joshua chapter 3. Verse 11, picking it up in verse 11. Behold, the ark of the covenant of all the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from every tribe, and it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of the Eternal, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off. The waters that come from down from upstream, and they'll stand as a heap. Now, what time of the year was this? Well, if you read chapter 5, you'll find out it was the springtime, when the flow is at its fullest and biggest and heaviest. It might have dried to a trickle later in the year, but it was pretty impressive at this time of year, no doubt. This sounds like a really great thing, unless you're a priest carrying the ark. Because it says you have to wade into the water, and then the water will pile up. Have you ever ridden a roller coaster? And have you ever had friends who say, you should be in the front car, it's more fun in the front? There were 12 priests. I wonder if some of them were saying, you should be in the front. It's more fun in the front. If you're stepping into a flood-swollen river carrying a burden, that's what was asked. Go forward. When you hit the turbulence, then I will intervene. Talk about faith. Talk about putting your money where your mouth is, or in the words of James, showing your faith by your works going forward. You can read the rest of the story. When the people set out from their camp to cross the Jordan with a priest bearing the ark, as those who bore the ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the ark dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest. The waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city beside Zeratan. So the waters that went down into the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Just as God said. Then the priests who bore the ark of the covenant of the Eternal stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. Quite a story. Quite a story. You notice the phrase in verse 17 about the priests? The priests who bore the ark stood firm. How about you and me and the challenges we face? The lesson? Well, sometimes the Israelites didn't really get the lessons. They built a little memorial, it says in chapter 4, verses 19 to 24, the stones they set up. But they didn't learn the lesson. It was to remind them. Then there was an unusual lesson in verse chapter 5. It seems that during the travels in the wilderness, none of the boy babies who were born had been circumcised according to the Abrahamic covenant, the covenant with Abraham. That was still very much in force back then, until it became clear as God began to reveal and working with people with his spirit in the New Testament on a much grander scale, that it was what Paul called circumcision of the heart that mattered. But that was to come much, much later. We're not told why this happened. Why hadn't they followed through on this sign of the covenant that they were working with back then? We're not told. We're only told in very general terms that the people had been disobedient. They had been disobedient. That's it. We don't know all the answers. Maybe part of it was their tendency to look back. They had trouble leaving Egypt. That certainly explains a lot of their disobedience. Moses ran full tilt into that so many times. Pretty clear lesson for us, though, before we enter our promised land, the kingdom of God, which the promised land was simply a type of, we will be required to have yielded hearts. Changed minds. You know, Revelation 22 is about as close to the end of the story as you can get. And in Revelation 22, in verse 15, we read these words, "Behold, I'm coming quickly. My reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city." And then we find all manner of sins and sinners listed and says they're not allowed in. And in verse 18 and 19, it says, "I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues written in the book. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, from the things written in this book." There are more lessons, of course, throughout this passage. Revelation 21 talks about, verse 6, "It is done. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts." And so many more verses. "He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I'll be his God, and he'll be my son. going forward into the family of God. Remarkable story, remarkable future. But there are yet more lessons back in the book of Joshua. Come back to Joshua 5. Joshua 5, following through on the outward sign of the covenant at that time, God says in verse 9, I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So they camped in Gilgal. They kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. They ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover. We can even tell the day, because if they ate of the produce of the land the day after the Passover, the day of the wave sheaf was the first day of the week that falls during the days of unleavened bread. Passover had to have been on the Friday night. We could even document that. Then the manna ceased, verse 12, after they'd eaten the produce of the land. Verse 13, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? He said, no, as commander of the army of the eternal, I have now come. I am the commander of the army of the eternal. Pretty obvious who this was. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said, what does my Lord say to his servant? Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot. The place where you stand is holy. And that was the encouragement before Jericho, and God intervened directly. That's what's next in chapter 6, the destruction of Jericho. Here are God's instructions. Verse 3, you'll march around the city, all you men of war. You go around the city once. You will do this 6 days. Seven priests will bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day, you'll march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpet. And it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up every man straight before him. Sounds puzzling. If you had been an Israelite at that time, you might have been saying, okay, let me get this straight. We march around the walls once a day for 6 days and say nothing. Then on the seventh day, we go around 7 times, blow on the horns and yell, and we win? Well, that's what happens when the commander of the army of the eternal is taking charge. Going forward. Essentially, yes, that's what happened. And for once in their history, we hear no complaints, no murmuring, and it happens just as God said it would. Isn't that symbolic? You sometimes hear references on the last day of unleavened bread to going forward. Tonight at sunset, the days of unleavened bread end. The metaphor of leaven picturing sin, and therefore even physical leaven to be avoided, ends at sunset. It ends. But are we to forget the lessons? No, we're not. God helps us to see that we need to leave sin behind. And that harkens back to the leadership of Moses. But he also helps us to see that we need to go forward into a future that he has prepared for us, the inheritance he has in mind. And that calls to mind comparisons to Joshua. Think about some of the passages you've read in the prophets in the book of Revelation. John tells us in Revelation 11:15, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and his Christ. We find references in Revelation 5 and Revelation 20 that show us we will be assisting him in the future. That's what we're called to do. We have to come out of spiritual Egypt. We have to leave sin behind. We're reminded every year with these special times. And we go forward. Back to Joshua, There was one complication from the assault of Jericho. Do you remember what it was? One man disregarded the instructions to not take any booty, any treasure, any wealth from the city. Verse 1 of chapter 7, the children of Israel committed a trespass offering regarding the accursed things. Notice the description. The children of Israel committed a trespass. Who did it? Did they all do it? One man. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. The anger of God burned against the children of Israel. They could go on to attack the next city. I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'll spell it Ai. And disaster strikes. They say, this is such a small place, just send 2,000 or 3,000 to go up and attack. And they're ambushed. They fall back. 36 of them die. What did those 36 do? One man's sin. Sin has a terrible, terrible consequence, doesn't it? Joshua's reaction, this is one moment where he seems to have reacted a little bit uncharacteristically. Verse 6 of Joshua 7, he tore his clothes, he fell to the earth on his face, and he and the elders of Israel, they put dust on their heads, all signs of mourning and terrible distress. And then Joshua says, "Alas, Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all? To deliver us to the hand of the Amorites? To destroy us?" Look at the picture. They have miraculously crossed the Red Sea. The Egyptian army is destroyed in the waters of the Red Sea. They have been granted a bloodless, casualty-free deliverance of the city of Jericho. And now an ambush kills tragically 36 men out of a nation of what? 2 million? 3 million? We don't know. 600,000 who were men 40 years before. That generation died off, but how big had the nation become since? We don't know. Perspective would have been helpful. He says, "O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns its back before its enemies? The Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it and surround us and cut off our name from the earth. We're all going to die. Then what will you do for your great name?" That was rather bold. And it wasn't the right approach. What was God's reaction? "So the Eternal said to Joshua, 'Get up. Why do you lie thus on your face?'" Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them. They've taken some of the accursed things, have stolen and deceived. They've put it among their own stuff. That's why Israel couldn't stand before their enemies. Isn't it interesting, brethren? Sometimes we don't see where to place a certain accountability and responsibility. Oh, our enemy is clever. We always have to contend with him. The deceit that he foists off on the world, can we see through it? There's another reaction you and I can have and learn from Joshua's reaction. After all God had done for them, there's just this tenuous grip on what all had happened. Even for a moment on the part of Joshua. It wasn't characteristic, it doesn't describe his life, but it does show he was human. And God spoke fairly strongly. He said, "Get up! Why are you lying on your face? Why don't you see what's happened? Why are you in despair? There is sin here. You've brought Egypt with you in that sense. You're coming into the inheritance I'm giving you. There's no place here for the leaven of the past. Until it's removed, my presence and my help are gone." And it was removed. This one man was required to pay with his life. and his family, who, because no doubt of the closeness of the habitations, he had buried the stuff in his tent. There was no way the rest of the family couldn't have known about that. Some things we look at and say, these are hard, hard lessons. How much even a little sin, one person in a nation of millions? There's a lesson. Remember Paul's letter to Corinth? Remember what he did with the one individual who was living in a totally inappropriate and immoral way? He said, put him out. It's corrupting the entire congregation. And then when he repented, he said, welcome him back. He's repented. He's right with me. It's interesting, of course, that we believe 1 Corinthians was written during, you guessed it, the days of unleavened bread. In Joshua's time, in the case of Achan, it resulted in the death of 36 innocent men in the first battle. And the total disheartening of all, including Joshua. You know what, brethren? You and I must support each other. We're part of a family. And it's so heartening when you see that that's exactly what's going on, as so often we do. Thank you for that. Chapter 9 of Joshua has another issue. The issue of the Gibeonites. You can read the story. You see here the inhabitants of Gibeon, verse 3, heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai. They worked craftily. They went and pretended to be ambassadors. They took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals, old garments, the bread of their provision, dry, moldy. So they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said, we've come from a far country. Please make a covenant with us, a treaty. And they said initially, well, wait a minute. How do we know you're not next door neighbors? That's not quite what it says, but they said, we're your servants. And Joshua said, who are you and where do you come from? And they, trotted out this story with all their props. And so they said, our leaders told us, travel, 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 long trip. When we left, our bread was fresh out of the ovens. Our clothes were brand new. Our sandals, we just picked them up, from Amazon.com. These wineskins were filled and new, and now they're torn. Verse 14, then the men of Israel took some of the provisions. They said, well, let us see the evidence. But they did not ask counsel of the Eternal. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the rulers of the congregation swore. 3 days later, guess what happens? They said, we might have made a slight mistake. We really are from the cities of Gibeon, Japhira, Beeroth, and Kirjath-Jearim, right next door. But Israel had promised. Have you and I ever done something like that? Charged ahead and said, this has got to be what God wants because it came to me in a night vision. This is what I really want to do, so God, will you please make sure that it's your will too? Have we ever done that before? How did that work out for us? Probably about like it did for ancient Israel. The story of the Gibeonites reverberates through their history. There are some important lessons there. Interestingly, the Gibeonites did not historically prove to be a problem. We even find references later in the days of Nehemiah, Nehemiah 3, verse 7, and Nehemiah 7, verse 25, that lead us to believe they may have become fully assimilated into the nation, like some who left Egypt with them and were willing to, in that case, go through the covenant of circumcision for the men. But on the other hand, having made a covenant with them, the Israelites from that point forward were compelled to defend them. In fact, you know the story about Joshua's long day? Do you know when that happened? It was when the Gibeonites were under attack. And they sent and pleaded. And they said, you have promised to take care to protect us. And they did. And Joshua said, we haven't dealt with the enemies yet. Please make the sun stand still so that we can finish the job. Gibeonites. It was in a battle, chapter 10, in defense of the Gibeonites. So, chapter 10, verse 13, the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the people had revenge on their enemies. All for Gibeon. God expected that they would keep their word. When Saul later went back on the agreement with the Gibeonites in 2 Samuel 21, the nation was punished. What about us? Is our word good? Even when we may have committed ourselves to something without seeking wise counsel, and I'm not talking about something sinful. I'm talking about you give your word to do something and then you realize that wasn't the wisest course. Do we keep our word, as it says in the 15th Psalm, even to our own hurt? That's an unleavened lesson, too. Read through the book of Judges, and you'll find numerous references to other peoples that the Israelites either couldn't or didn't drive out. And in most cases, that became a stumbling block to them because of the false gods and the idol worship that they practiced. Can we learn lessons from that, too, in moving forward to our inheritance? Do we understand that drawing too close to worldly practices can distance us from God? Read 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 to 18. Read James 4 and verse 4, where it warns us about that very thing. There's one last lesson I'd like to point out to us on this last day of unleavened bread and this message this morning in 2023. It's effectively or efficiently in how we say goodbye to this life. What kind of a legacy do we leave? With as much determination and grit and faithfulness as we exhibited all through that life, from our youth to our last breath. Joshua 23 is a remarkable account. We find it says that God had given them rest from all their enemies, and Joshua was old, advanced in age. So in verse 2, he called for all of Israel, the elders, the heads, the judges, their officers, and said, I'm old, advanced in age. You've seen what God has done to all the nations because of you, because he fought for you. I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes. From the Jordan, with all the nations I've cut off as far as the great sea westward, God will expel them and drive them before you if that's what he intends, and drive them out of your sight. You'll possess the land as God has promised you. That's his will. Therefore, be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right or to the left. And lest you go among these nations who remain among you, you will not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You will not serve them or bow down to them. You'll hold fast to the Lord your God as you've done to this day. The Lord has driven out from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you this day. Verse 10, your God, Lord your God, is he who fights for you as he promised. Brethren, he fights for us too. And he's with us too, if we are determined to be his obedient children. Determined to learn the lesson of leaven. Determined to learn the lesson of the leadership of Moses in leaving Egypt behind. But also determined to learn the lesson of Joshua, to go forward in courage. Verse 11, take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God. And he warns them, if you don't, you will not last. And in verse 14, he says, behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. You know that in all of your hearts and in all your soul that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass, not one word has failed. But, and again, he warns them what happens with transgressions and disobedience. So he gathers them together, rehearses the story, and in verse 15, the very famous words that we sometimes see as artwork in our homes, maybe. If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal." Oh, they promised, and his example was so strong. We find in chapter 24, verse 31, after he was dead and buried, "Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of God which he had done for Israel." Remarkable story, a remarkable man. His legacy lasted beyond his lifetime. Even the succeeding lifetimes of the leaders who outlived him, it was finally in the third generation that they began to go astray. And here you and I are on the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread 2023. Don't go, you know, don't forget there's an afternoon service at 3 p.m. Not done yet. And just as we all knew it would, the week has flown past. In a few more hours, the symbolism of leaven representing sin will no longer physically apply. But the lessons have to stay with us. Leave Egypt behind, as Moses' example showed us, and go forward with faith and determination and courage toward our inheritance, as the leadership of Joshua showed us. The lessons from ancient Israel did not end when Moses died. The theme of his guidance was leaving Egypt. The theme of Joshua's leadership was going forward in courage. How important are both to you and me? If I can borrow a New Testament verse that seems to speak to this circumstance, it's one you've probably heard once or twice during these days of unleavened bread in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8. It says in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8, "Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness," we leave that behind, "but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." That's what we push forward to embrace, adopt as our own, and go forward as we remember the echoes of Joshua and the word spoken to him: "Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go."